This is the Agile Uprising Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Agile Uprising Podcast. Tonight we will be talking about the next of the Modern Agile principles in the Modern Agile series. The topic of tonight will be experiment and learn rapidly. I'm the host this evening, Ryan Lockard, and I am joined by Paul Elia. Say hey, Paul.
Hey, guys.
Got your name right?
Check.
Tonight we also have a guest host on, Mike Ackerbauer. Mike, do you mind just saying hey and giving everyone a heads up of who you are and what you do?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Ryan. I'm Mike Ackerbauer. I'm with IBM. I'm a whole team evangelist, which means I work with Agile practitioners and Agile practitioners-to-be, and I help them collaborate better, and I help bring out their creative best. I got involved in Agile a couple years ago in the company, but I've always been in the creative problem-solving space, and I find the two really mesh well together, and so I've just created kind of a niche for myself doing both, bringing modern practices to a big company and also helping people understand how they can do their creative best in that environment.
Cool. Yeah, and Mike, you and I actually first crossed paths in the Modern Agile Slack community, and then we met in that terrifying place that we call real life shortly after. And I know that this is an area that you're passionate about, so really happy to have you on. Great add to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So like I said, this is the second show in a 4-to-5 show series about the Modern Agile principles.
No, it's definitely going to be 5. Joshua says he's game. So we're going to recap in the end and have Karievsky on the show. Yeah. Like, let's just go ahead and throw that out there. Let's do it, right?
Yeah. So Josh is a friend of the show, so he'll definitely be on. So tonight we're going to really scope in on experiment and learn rapidly. And, you know, to publicly put out there my reading skills, what Modern Agile has to say about this principle is that you can't make people awesome or make safety a prerequisite if you aren't learning. We learn rapidly by experimenting frequently. We make our experiments safe to fail, so we're not afraid to conduct more experiments. When we get stuck or aren't learning enough, we take it as a sign that we need to learn more by running more experiments. So I think as we go into these, the right place to start is to define the thing that we're going to talk about. There's actually, it's a pretty direct statement, but there's actually a lot of nested things in there that we probably need to unpack here. And I think the safest place to start tonight's conversation is really just leaning on you guys and asking the simple question, what does this actually mean to you when we talk about experimenting and learning rapidly and creating a safety to fail and looking at the amount of learning that we're having as an indicator of a need for more experiments? So, Paul, I'm going to, I guess, lean on you first and just ask you, what does this actually mean to you and how do you understand this principle?
Yeah, so there's a lot of good thought leadership going on right now, kind of highlighting this, but this has been around for a while. And it's gone by different names, but I'm glad we're getting back to the focus because it's one of the things I like about the name of our group, Agile Uprising. And it almost feels like we're kind of trying to bring back the core basics. And these core basics were there from the beginning. We hear about things from the military like OODA loop, right? The observe, orient, decide, and act. We've got lean startups, build, measure, learn loop, heart of agile, Coburn's work, collaborate, deliver, reflect, and improve, Deming, originally PDCA, now PDSA, the plan, do, study, act. And he got his stuff from his teacher, Schuhart Cycle. So, and I got to believe that this stuff goes back to Sumerian tablets somewhere, right? It just makes sense. It's do something, learn from it. Do something, learn from it. I mean, I'm shortening it even further. But one of the things that And I'm 30 years in my career. I've seen the pendulum swing back and forth, and I'm so excited that it's swinging back to taking more action and learning from it, Because in the beginning, we didn't have so much specialization, at least beginning of my career. It was, you were a jack of all trades. You know, they were looking for musicians to become software engineers. My degree in computer science, if I had graduated a year earlier, it would have been mathematics because we didn't have a computer science degree. So you were a jack of all trades doing this. And everything we did was kind of try something, see what works, And now we are getting back to that. And I'm so glad. So I know I went through show notes here and just kind of listed off all these different ways that, you know, and I talk about the DevOps infinity loop. I'm the DevOps Center of Enablement head at SunTrust Bank. And I'm constantly drawing the DevOps infinity loop. So all this stuff is related, and I'm glad Modern Agile made it one of the four.
Right.
So
I guess...
Go ahead.
I guess, Mike, kind of feeding off of where Paul started there, when you look at this and you talk about experimenting and learning rapidly with your folks at IBM or people that you work with outside of your core professional space, what does it mean to you? How do you interpret it and apply it?
Yeah, so I follow a model called breakthrough thinking that is very similar to the ones you just listed, Paul. See how similar this sounds to you. The breakthrough thinking model says for any kind of problem or challenge that I'm facing, the first thing I'm going to do is clarify a problem. I'm going to generate ideas to address that problem or challenge. And I look at problems as anything that separates you from your current reality to your desired future state. Taking some of those raw ideas and developing them into some sort of solution, and then implementing. So plan, do, check, and act, or plan, do, study, act. IBM used to have a model of design thinking that we looked at understand, explore, prototype, evaluate. I think the pattern here is very clear. And from an implementation standpoint, when we're moving forward on some plan or we're taking action and trying something out, I've always understood implementation to be test fast, fail fast, adjust fast. So I'm trying it. Does it work? Does it stick to the wall? It isn't that I don't give it time to evaluate, but if it's not working, how do I inspect it and adapt, move on? And IBM has actually revamped their design thinking model to an infinity loop where the left side of the loop is observation. The right side is making something. And in the middle, at the inflection point between the two is reflection. So observe, reflect, make. Right. And it's so similar that I have to believe you're right. The Sumerians originated all this.
Exactly. Exactly. Actually, I just saw IBM in a presentation and they present that very slide. So yeah, I mean,
that thing resonates with me because you're always circling back. If we understand right. That it's not linear, plan, do, check, act isn't, well, I planned enough. Now I'm just going to go, I don't have to plan anymore. At some point I'm going to iterate back and go, well, it did or didn't work. Where did I miss in the planning? Or did I hit the target that I was aiming for? Did I hit the right problem that I implement against the right challenge? Well, let me reflect on it. Let's come back and let's, you know, just continuously in a linear fashion, I'm doing that infinity loop. I'm circling back all the time.
Right. And I think, and we got to get Ryan's view in here. Go Ryan.
So I think I agree with everything you guys said. There's two discrete elements that I think are super important here. And if I'm channeling my inner Josh, the word creating safety to fail is super important. And the other piece would be the speed at which we learn and the speed at which we experiment, right? We can say that, you know, RUP or... some of these large scale frameworks embrace experimentation because they say it. But to me, an experiment is something that you should be able to get feedback in very short feedback loops. And I'll even quantify that as to say, I like getting feedback loops every single day. Maybe I'm not running a new experiment every day. Maybe it takes me 2, 3, 4, 5 days to run an experiment. But I like having input sensors from production or from my in-state environment, so that I'm getting logging, alerting, or trending from either my production environment or a subset of my users in my production environment. And because I'm getting that feedback, I'm getting the first layer of that safety, right? Data doesn't lie, typically.
Yeah.
Right, there's my parentheses.
Yeah.
If you're creating, an engineering mindset in your organization, which I'm a big proponent of, you're going and you start with the idea that, you know, you want to learn from your production environment, you want to learn from your users and all that. Everything you do should be giving you feedback loops to the people that make decisions, and those feedback loops are going to give you the safety. Beyond that, as much as I believe in creating an engineering first environment, I think it's also important to make the people that are not on the core engineering or delivery team highly aware of what's going on around them as we shift their context. Moving from a big upfront planning or big upfront design culture to one where you're creating a safety for experimentation and learning means that you have to invite those that are also supposed to experiment and learn along with you into the conversation and into the change initiative. So if I'm working with a product manager and I'm going through and doing some pretty slick feature toggling, and I'm putting in some additional alerting and analytics into the code, I'm instrumenting my code, or, you know, I'm doing some A/B testing, whatever it is that I'm doing on the slick engineering side of the house, I damn sure have to make sure that those people that are in charge of prioritization and that are probably involved in the funding of my work know what the hell we're doing and know how to actually rely on that information to feel safe in their decisions and their prioritization rankings and things of that nature. So I agree with everything you guys said. I just I would take it a little further and make sure that we're creating that robust 360 safety, and also making sure that we're constantly seeking out shortening that feedback loop so we can make smaller mistakes.
Right, right, totally.
Cool.
When you say that, though, when you want to close those feedback loops faster, would you possibly say that if I'm going to build an experiment, I may just want to have a contingency for stakeholder awareness, for keeping people in the loop, no pun intended? Mm-hmm. Where's the intersection there for you?
So it depends on the maturity of the organization, and the way the question was phrased, I'm assuming we're talking about a relatively immature organization from a rapid experiment stance. If that were the case, I would probably start with a non-technical experiment and pull them into that conversation so that I'm minimizing the amount of variables that are going to either cause stress, confusion, or frustration. It could be something as simple as a paper prototype that I take to internal stakeholders and watch the non-technical folks realize what it means to get real user data in real time. If it's a slightly more mature organization, maybe we do something like some HTML mockups or something, some clickable prototypes where we're not investing a whole lot of engineering effort into it, but we're still getting real time feedback loops, and then just mature that along until we're actually doing, you know, a 1% production, you know, user experiment where we blast something out that we're pretty sure is going to be throwaway code, but we run it against live users to see how they respond to it. So I think it's one of those pragmatic iterative things, which at some point I imagine the folks that are loyal listeners are going to create like a Agile Uprising bingo card and a pragmatic check, fail fast check, iterative check. But I just threw a couple of buzzwords out there and I hate myself for it.
And then anyway, your bingo.
Yeah. I opened a couple cans before we got started, yeah. So that you don't hear the cracks as we go here. But Mike, to answer your question directly, assuming I'm starting with an immature team, I'd want to like crawl, walk, run through the experimentation cycle and evolve with them so that they feel safe and they understand what these new input sensors are.
Yeah, and I think when we talk about experimentation, it could be so broad you have to constrain it or give it some structure. I don't mean experiment like here, hold my beer in a corporate setting. I'm talking about I'm going to try something because we have some hypothesis about what the outcome might be. We're just not certain of it until we try it. Okay, so it didn't work quite like we wanted to. How do we dial it in a little bit more, or are we going down the right path? No, well then let's circle back and make sure everybody's happy with that we're going the right direction. But I was thinking about a job I had years ago when I wrote code for a company, and we were experimenting with, this is how far back it was, I was doing active server pages. I was a database architect, and I'm writing stored procedures that are getting called by active server pages, and I'm testing it to see if it'll work, but all of my experimentation was done privately. There was no way I was going to test it and say, hey guys, look at this, to an executive, and it didn't work. So it was really well contained. I'm going to play with this a lot because I want to see what can be done, but I'm controlling it to the extent that nobody's going to know if I fail, because I don't want to set an expectation and not be able to meet it.
Well, that's interesting. That's actually one of the things that we want to, part of the safety is the safety to not have to think that way. And so take it, let me make sure I spit it out properly. It's that's going solo, right? And
that was actually the intent was to delight my end user, but I didn't want to set up an expectation.
Yeah, sure. No, that's great. But so bear with me one sec. It sounded like you're saying I don't want to show anybody something unless it works. Did you have teammates working with you?
Sure. Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It wasn't. Call it more like Skunk Works. I wonder what I could do with this. Let me just see. Well, if it works, then major coup. They'll be excited. I've got a new system that we can use. If it doesn't work, I don't disappoint them by setting an expectation I can't meet.
Yeah, but so did you do the Skunk Works project with other people?
There was some collaboration, sure.
Cool. Okay.
Actually, as you guys were talking, I realized we keep throwing out this word experiment. I know what I mean when I say experiment, and I'm actually curious, Paul, when you talk about an experiment in the delivery perspective, like we're really talking about
scientific method. And I think the big thing, especially larger companies that have been at the game of delivering solutions for a long time, have a harder time because we've gone through this period of structured Gantt chart, right? PMO, everything. Mm-hmm. And what I want to know is what's the least costly, least time consuming way to validate a hypothesis? Like I don't want to do a project. I just want a small change and to learn something from that small change. And
so here's where
go ahead.
Here's where I challenge you, because I actually I think that's a shared definition of an experiment that a lot of people have, and I agree with everything except you said to validate a hypothesis. In my opinion, talk about safety, we're talking about
to find out what invalidating happens.
Well, no, we want to invalidate hypotheses.
Yeah, we could invalidate too.
If we're setting up experiments to prove that something is right, we're actually setting off on the wrong foot, I think.
I like it. I like it. That's a good correction to what I'm saying.
Yeah, we should have more failed experiments than passing experiments. Otherwise, are we actually learning anything?
Yeah.
Or are we just setting up controls to prove ourselves right and make ourselves look right, look correct?
Yeah, so to prove or disprove a hypothesis. I appreciate that. That's good.
Yeah. Mike, is that a shared definition with you, or would you add anything to that?
Yeah, I would say there needs to be some scientific rigor to it, which means I've clarified the nature of the challenge that I'm experimenting against mm-hmm. up front. So I'm not just willy-nilly trying different things.
Right.
So I think of Edison saying, I didn't fail to create a light bulb 10,000 times. I found 9,999 ways not to do it. So there was clearly...
He started with a premise and a hypothesis and something he was shooting for.
And he reflected back and said, does this work?
Yep.
No. Okay, what I missed? Try it again.
Yep.
Yeah. Now, in my case, when I'm talking about what I did with this little Skunk Works project, I was showing a reporting system on the browser instead of on a green screen. So they could get their reporting on our clients' usage of our systems anytime they wanted. What I wanted to be able to do is show them, you go on our browser in our intranet, and click any client, and you can see what their billing status is today.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like I'd failed by not doing it with their knowledge. I succeeded greatly by surprising them and delighting them with it.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with it. So lots of cool things happen that way. You hope in a more mature environment, you hope there are moments where folks are given the opportunity to do hackathons and experiment and have the safety to even do those kind of things out in the open.
Sure.
I think that's a maturity thing.
So how do we celebrate failure when it happens? Or how do we deal with failure?
Learning all the time.
Sure.
Right. Yeah. So this is Jürgen Apollo has his celebration grid, which is really cool. And also on this, along the same lines of this, sometimes the outcome's good. Sometimes it's bad.
Yeah. Yeah.
Celebrate.
Right. I just want to,
what did we learn from it?
I want to thank you both for, I don't really get to feel young that often. Paul, you mentioned you've been in this for 30 years, and Mike, you're talking about green screens migrating to browsers. So,
Thank you. I started on Fortran, brothers. I'm still going. I'm a lifelong kid. I just got back from a university recruitment event for SunTrust Bank, and it's good to be around the young energy again. But hey, you're the young guy, brother.
Yeah, I appreciate you old bastards.
Yeah,
Paul, if you were doing Fortran, I feel young too. Thank you.
I was doing artificial intelligence in Fortran, so that's another conversation for another day. I was hip even on the mainframe.
Full disclosure, I never used a punch card, but I did do COBOL program on the mainframe in college.
I at least avoided COBOL professionally. What's ironic is I never wanted to work for a bank, and if I had gone to work for a bank, I probably wouldn't have this cool job I have right now. But I did have a punch card experience, unfortunately. I drew the diagonal line through the top of the cards in case I dropped the deck. That, for those of you out there in the audience who are listening, you know what I'm talking about.
Which brings us full circle back to experimentation versus failure. I actually did get paid for a single project consulting in COBOL. I didn't understand how to write COBOL until the day after the final. So how I got hired, I'll never know, but this will prove how well I knew it. I wrote some sort of delete process that I was instructed to do. And I think one of us didn't test it, or somehow it got put into production. So it wiped something out that shouldn't have been. And they didn't celebrate my failure.
Well, that's a maturity thing too, right? So we talk about that. We talk about some of the unicorns. I don't have to mention companies by name, but we know the unicorns. We're all kind of striving to do the number of deployments they do per day and all this stuff. They celebrate those moments.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's mm-hmm. safety. That's cool safety right there.
Yeah.
So let's then dig into this then. So how do you guys, like, how have you experimented with teams in the past? How have you made failure safe in teams, or maybe not you directly, but how have you heard about this being embraced in the culture of an organization? Like, what tactical things can listeners start attaching themselves to understand how this happens?
Yeah, Mike, you go first.
A couple of years ago, we started, we kind of adopted a new paradigm, and we started adopting third-party tools, best-of-breed tools internally for collaboration. And we were stringing them together in a tool chain and working on them. And I don't remember which tool or what happened or what went down. I just remember that everybody swarmed on the problem when it happened. And it was, we actually used the tools that we had just licensed, and then we made available to the entire company on our intranet the transcript of our Slack conversation as we were working the problem all the way through, and we shared everything that we had learned and done as it was happening as a blog for everybody to read and dissect. And when we identified the problem, we went back and we did what I hadn't heard of until then, was called a blameless postmortem.
Yeah.
And it was refreshing to walk through everything. And because we knew we were safe to talk about what we did or didn't do or what happened, we weren't pointing fingers. Nobody got thrown under the bus. But one or two guys said, you know what? I didn't stop and take a look at this, or I didn't check that before we went to the next step, or I overlooked, or I wasn't aware. But there was no piling on because somebody did something. We learned from it. We applied it. We were very transparent about it, and we moved on.
It's cool. How about you, Paul? Same question, I guess. How Paul, how have you embraced this in your practice?
Yeah, so a couple things came to mind working up the notes for the show. We've got the concept of breaking the build, and it's kind of like the lean manufacturing Andon cord, pronunciation, yeah. Kanban, people.
The stop the line methodology.
Stop the line, right? So, you know, when the assembly line breaks, everybody swarms. That's what Mike was just talking about. But to make it fun, one of the things that I've seen is to exchange some kind of token for the person who broke the build. And it's like a stuffed animal. It's a goofy stuffed animal or something like that. And it's a celebration of, it's a safety attitude and a vibe. Like Joe broke the build. You get to hold the goofy stuffed animal while we get this fixed. And you're going to have the goofy stuffed animal on your desk for a little while until we get back to no incidents for a bit. And then we'll put it in a desk drawer.
So how do you make that safe, and how do you not make that the Scarlet Letter?
I don't know.
I've seen a lot of people try to pull that off, and I think while it's mostly done with good intent, it quickly turns into the badge of dishonor.
I think that's where agile leaders come in. So one of the things that, again, agile uprising, loving the vibe and loving what we're our purpose is. The middle management doesn't get recognized properly for their role in moving to agile. They have a pivotal role in making it successful to have that true safety and to carry that vibe. And you got to mean it. You got to mean it, and you got to be out there, and you got to laugh with your people when stuff like that happens. You got to celebrate the learning. You got to do the blameless postmortem kind of stuff. It's up to the agile leader to make that safe. That's so important.
Yeah. I think I would want my leader to be the first one to get the award, or to find a way to model the behavior of how do we celebrate this? How do we learn from it in a productive way that sets the example and sets the tone at the leadership level for everyone else to follow?
Yeah.
I'll flip it on its head. We've had I'm one of the leaders in my church, and we used to have a question that would come up occasionally. How do we increase church attendance? And I took the moment to say to everybody, by giving a really crazy idea, I would do it to say the environment is safe, and if I can say something crazy, so can you. And so before the question came off the person's lips, I would yell, "Free beer." and everybody'd laugh and go, you know, they just didn't know what to do with it. And I wouldn't do it necessarily because I was advocating for it, although I did actually go to a local brewery and I inquired and I talked to the brewmaster. That's another story for another time. But by saying that, I was opening up the space to be safe so everyone else could feel like they could ask, throw out a really dumb idea.
Yeah.
When we do design thinking sessions internally, one of the steps you do at the beginning is sort of an icebreaker. Get to know each other is you get to write out your superpowers on post-it notes.
Yeah.
And you get to put three or four up, and you get to put a few up about somebody else you know, and you get to pick the one that you feel like really resonates with you and means the most for this session. And so I would always, always select asks dumb questions as my superpower to make the statement to everybody else that if you don't ask it, but you want to know the answer, I'm going to do it for you. So at least you don't feel like you're the only one.
Yep.
Yeah.
I think it's a powerful persona to own because quite often in fear-riddled cultural organizations, that does not happen enough. And people sit on their questions because of the fear of ridicule, right? So having somebody like that, like you, Mike, that's willing to take that and run it forward introduces the opportunity for others to do it. And then there's real learning and there's... you know, you get to restate the problems quite often by asking a stupid question. And I think...
And that's the happy byproduct, right? Because then I get to learn faster. Mm-hmm. And if I'm going through a session and I don't know what the terminology is or the acronyms or the things we're talking about, and I wait until halfway through or the next day, I've missed all kinds of opportunity to contribute.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Making it safe to not know something, that's definitely part of it.
I think for me, when I was getting ready for this and I was thinking about how have I used experimentation with teams in the past, if I feel like this is queued up for me to talk about test-driven development, like this would be the perfect time for me to talk about it. But I'm kind of conscious of the fact that the past few shows I've been on, I took a very strong technical stance. And I did not want to do that, especially after I heard you, Paul, talking about breaking the build. I figured you kind of carried the torch for me. So kind of attaching myself to what Mike just said about design thinking, I had in a past role, I had an amazing lean UX practitioner that I hired onto the team. And about 3 months after the Google Ventures book came out called Sprint, both myself and this UX guy independently read it, and we went out to lunch or dinner or drinks or something, and we were talking, and we said, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we did this thing I just read, and turned out we both read the same thing, called the Google Design Sprint, which is a formulaic 1 week approach to identifying an experiment, iterating through the experiment, getting group consensus on the problem, the persona, and a solution that we can run, developing a very lo-fi prototype of that, and reviewing it with actual users, and at the end of the week having a plan from which you can either move forward or just completely scrap, right? And actually being able to pull that off not once but multiple times in a very large regulated enterprise was a really cool way to embrace learning and experimentation. And it was a really cool way to break down some of those cultural boundaries that we put around ourselves in that enterprise culture. You know, like a lot of times people marry their ideas, and when you say an idea isn't going to work, they take it as a personal affront. But if you're, that's because we're betting ourselves on these 6 to 12 month ideas. If you're doing a very transient thing, like a 15 minute idea, it's no longer part of your identity. So crumpling up that piece of paper and throwing it in the bin is nowhere near as offensive as something that's much more large scale. So I think that was a really cool way. And if you haven't yet read Google Sprint, it's definitely worth picking up. I think it's like only 200 pages. You could probably read it on a short flight. But what's cool about it is you can kind of adapt it and use it in your enterprise as a quick way to gather consensus and learning.
Yeah, cool. Yeah I mean, so it's like the attitude and the vibe that you displayed with, hey, I'm going to push back on you, Paul. Validate a hypothesis. How about prove or disprove? And it's like, oh, yeah, no, absolutely. Learning. I'm going to adapt the way I say that.
Yeah.
Didn't feel like you were telling me I was wrong. Felt like you were making me a better practitioner.
Yeah, I've gotten that feedback before. When I tell people they're wrong, they don't feel like I'm telling them they're wrong. So I got to try harder.
No, what I love, you know, is one of the things that I love when I first started listening to you guys before I was had the privilege of joining is I don't completely disagree with you.
Yeah,
you guys say that a lot. I love it.
No, I've outright called bullshit on people on this show, I think.
No, absolutely. But I love that. I mean, you know, I don't completely disagree with you. And that's one of my phrases where I go back and say, okay, but what part did you actually agree with? And what part don't you agree with? I'd like to know.
Yeah, I don't completely disagree with you, but here's where you could be less wrong.
Yeah, that's cool.
All right, so putting us back on the tracks here. So we spent a good bit of time talking about experimentation and different techniques and such. I think one thing that's worth digging into here is, Mike, you had shared with me some content that you created and you know, we kind of talked about this, I believe it was either Panera or Starbucks, about when you work with teams, what are the three keys for strong teams? And the reason I'm bringing this up in this conversation is because I think your keys actually attach themselves very much the experimentation and the learning of modern Agile. So if you don't mind, do you mind stepping us through as best you can what those keys are and how they resonate with experimentation and learning?
Yeah, no, I don't mind at all. We found some of the more seasoned Agile coaches that I've worked with and I have collaborated on this, and I've done a lot of research in the fields of creative problem solving and breakthrough thinking. That's my area of focus that I've brought to the Agile community. And I've thought, when I see a really good Agile team, that's what's there is when they're autonomous and they're self-directed, it means that they've been given liberty to experiment. They've been given liberty to try out new ways of delighting their customers or the users, and most of their destiny is in their own hands. What does that look like if we break that down? Why is it like that some teams are like that and they're really what we call shining innovators, and others would like to be, but they're not? And I always felt originally when I was learning Agile that the natural outcome of Agile should be innovation. And I found in working with teams that that is not always the case. Well, what is it that's different when it is the case? And we found these three core things at minimum. It's not quite scientific, but it resonates across all the teams I've ever worked with. One, you really need to have a strong sense of shared understanding. And we just went through that tonight, where we talked about, well, what do you mean by experiment? Well, what is the purpose of our team? What are our goals? And what is our commitment to those goals to achieve them? So we've got to know, it's like clarity of outcome, but it's not quite. It's why are we here? Mm-hmm. And what are we here for? And how are we going to work together to get there? So you've got to have that understanding. You also have to have more than just the Agile practices. You have to have some sort of creative process to bring out whatever it is we would call innovation. And I use these two working definitions. Creativity is anything that is novel that is useful, or novel that is meaningful. So it could be novel and meaningful to me, but not you. That makes it creative. Mm-hmm. But if it's novel and meaningful to both of us, and it changes your behavior, or we worked on it to make it even more useful and novel, that's when it becomes innovative. It's when there's changed behavior. We could use the term disruptive. I know semantically it's a hot button a little bit. But if it changes behavior of other people because they found the novelty and the meaning or the applicability, that's when it becomes innovative. So you've got to have a process that you can – go ahead.
So I guess to illustrate that point, would that be if it's something novel that may be meaningful to one person – we're talking about Google Glass, for example. But yeah, if we're talking about something innovative where it's novel and it changes behavior, iPhone, right?
Or
smartphones in the more generic. Because one of them is pervasive and the other was a flash in the pan.
You could say there's scales of disruption or scales of change behavior. Google Glass certainly made an impact for a time. It just didn't have sustainability for whatever reason. So you could say it was disruptive, and it wasn't necessarily, and you could even say it is an innovation, but is it something we'd repeat? Is it a product that we would continue to pursue?
So I think they're making a version too right now.
Okay. So there's an experiment there that they reiterated on, and maybe it'll be better this time. We don't know. I mean, my team for many years in CIO before I was in the Agile Academy, we were in the innovation space. And we always had that debate, well, is it novel? Is it innovation because nobody has built this app before? Or is it innovation because it's helping teams get better at doing what they do? So did I do the right work or did I do the work right? There's a little bit of that dynamic in there.
Right.
But anything that produces something on a regular basis, it's repeatable in that I can, if I'm deliberate about how I want to be inventive, I can delight my user. And it's not necessarily built in to Agile. So it's got to be part of the mindset, and maybe it's got to be, I don't know if it comes before or after or alongside, but it's got to be resident there along with an Agile mindset of trust and openness and respect and courage and empathy. And those are the principles that we abide by that really set the environment to be able to then become creative. And you've got to have that safe space to be creative, because you could become vulnerable. If I share an idea with you and you say, man, that idea sucks. What have you just said to me? You didn't like the idea, but what I heard was somehow I'm not measuring up as a human being.
Oh, yeah. It's not that your idea sucks. We just said you suck.
Right, right. So, side note, I teach a technique on this that says affirm the person by affirming the idea. You don't have to like the idea. You don't even have to commit to the idea. But if you'll just walk through the process of evaluating it with somebody in a constructive manner, you're bound to come away with a better alternative or another right. way of doing something.
Right.
That everybody says, wow, thanks for the time.
Yep.
Well, you've got to have a process for that. And that's what I touched on earlier, Paul, with my variation of plan, do, study, and act. We call it breakthrough thinking. And I can talk about that part all night, but let me show you the third dynamic is the team has a dynamic, and I have to understand what it is. So let me step back. Number one, I've got to have a shared understanding or a team purpose. I've got to have some sort of process for creative output or potentially for innovative product. And the third is I've got to understand how my team prefers to work together around their own preferences. And that's tightly coupled to the specific model I'm talking about called breakthrough thinking, which says at any point in time that anybody ever faces a challenge, they will walk through those four steps. It turns out it is, and research will bear this out, it is their native problem-solving language. We just call it different things, and typically it's an unconscious competence that we have. We don't think about how we do it, we just do it. But calling out the process that people already do and showing them where their energy is in that process, because the breakthrough thinking model of clarification, ideation, development, implementation, they're very distinct modalities, and you've got to apply a different mental process to each of them. And your personality and mine are different, so we will engage those differently. So I need to know how you're going to engage the same challenge with me, so we don't have conflict, we can have creative tension, because I'm aware of your preferences and their differences to mine. I can be empathetic toward that, and then we can get some sort of creative abrasion going or creative tension that builds a better idea.
Yeah, empathy, respect, the climate of safety are so key.
And if you don't have it, and I throw out an idea, and you mock me for it, or you're sarcastic, will I ever give you an idea again?
Exactly. Right. No, I love it.
Yeah. Creative abrasion. I love it.
Isn't that a great term?
Yeah.
It is. And I don't know that I've heard it before, and it may live in that mindset that you've been talking through here, but it's one that I think I got to start using a little bit more. Creative abrasion. It gives a sense of healthiness in an otherwise negative, what can become a negative area. So,
yeah. Hey Mike, I got a question for you. So, part of what you were describing is, you know, letting people do problem solving, I guess, the way they're used to doing it, something to that effect. And actually, yep. Could you just restate that so that I'm not misquoting you?
Sure. So, what we've discovered in 60 years of research in creativity is there are these four discrete steps that everybody does, and they're universal. They strongly complement one another if you follow them well. One of my instructors always said, my professors always said, trust the process, but process is a cruel mistress. So you got to understand it. It's lightning in a bottle. How do I really engage it? But it comes down to this. Anytime you see a gap between where you are and where you want to be, the first thing you're going to do is define the gap. You're going to clarify what is the nature of the problem I'm facing, or the challenge, or the opportunity. And you're going to go look for context. You're going to look for data. One of the models, the early models of the process, they call it mess finding, which I think is really fantastic. What kind of mess did we find ourselves in, and what's the history and the context and the data? Okay, now that I have a better understanding of it, and I've put some of my assumptions out on the table, so they're not assumed anymore. Okay, what is the real problem we're facing? You know, in root cause analysis, if you do five whys, typically the problem people bring you is a symptom, not a root cause.
Right.
So if I ask you enough whys, we'll get to the level of abstraction of how I can either move forward on the right challenge, or I identify a blocker that's holding me back that I can just go attack. So clarification is key. A problem well-defined is half solved. So then once I have a good context for my problem space, I can go ideate. That's number two. Clarification is one. Two is ideation. It just means let me bring some new thought or some novel thought to the problem space. Typically, you and I will throw ideas out that we've already tried. They're well-worn. They're things we've done in the past. And if you do enough brainstorming and it's well facilitated, what they have found in research is the best ideas come out in the last third. And that's because if you defer judgment through the process, you can build on other people's ideas. You can go wild and crazy. And the more novelty, the more potential for novelty, the more potential for a good idea that stands apart from the others. So that's sort of where the creative abrasion can kick in too, is you throw an idea out and I piggyback on it, and you throw another one out and it gets wilder and crazier, and suddenly we're at free beer in church.
Yeah. So it's the and then game or something like that. That's one of the
yes,
coaching.
And. Yes. And
yeah. Yes. And yes. And. Yeah. Right.
It absolutely can be. It's really just about deferring judgment and allowing yourself to empty your mental queue until you have to make these forced connections. Mm-hmm. That's where the really special ideas live. Now, let's say we've got a bunch of ideas. It could be three or four. It doesn't have to be hundreds. Depends on the nature of the problem solving you're doing. But now you've got a few ideas, and a couple of them have promise, but I'm not sure which one to go with, or I'm not fully sure what it's going to look like. Number three is developing solutions out of ideas. So I'm taking those raw thoughts and deciding, well, what would it look like if it were true? Well, I'd have to do this, and I'd have to work on that, and we'd have to have this piece, and we'd have to write that code. So you're kind of fleshing out the plan, but you're really evaluating the idea and what merit it has and looking at what needs to be there for it to really be able to be sustainable or to come to life. And that's also where you start into the prioritization process. So it turns out that fits really well with story planning and deciding on what's my acceptance criteria, what are my done conditions, and then how, say, as the product owner, am I going to decide which ones are first? And finally, you've got to take that plan, whatever it is you fleshed out, you've got to bring it to life. You've got to move it into action. Implementation is really not just executing on it. It's about bringing in all the right people that you need to work with and collaborate with. And so, you know, when you write code, you don't write it in a vacuum in the sense that just the developers worked on it and we deployed it and now it works. You've got to check in with the stakeholder or the product owner or the, if it's finance, you've got to talk to those people.
Oh yeah. The guys are going to have to answer the, I about said the word pager, but I'll say it anyway, pager calls, right? Yeah, absolutely.
So the solution itself may not be enough because now I have to get some sort of buy-in from people who are going to use it or consume it.
Right.
That's a whole nother level of creative abrasion of, you know, talking through what does it mean? And you end up re-clarifying everything you've done to say, this is what we plan to do. How does it look? Is it right on? Mm. And then you go through the process almost all over again within implementation. But that's when the scale kicks in, when the collaboration comes in, that's when the innovation can come out is, well, is this the best way to do it? And how will it affect these people? And what about purchasing?
Yeah.
So there's all of that meshing that goes on.
So Mike, I'm glad you clarified all these roles because one of the part of my question, I wanted to get clear on the pattern that you've got here. And I love it. How do you, and I know we're running long on time. We're probably going to have to cut here soon. We like to keep these things down. But the team element, how do you prevent people from going Lone Ranger? Like, you know, a lot of waterfall, I know the waterfall word is an activating word, but I just used it. It's too late. It's out of the bag. But the old mentality of I'm going to assign a task to an individual is so ingrained in people who've been working in the especially the solution technology space. How do you break them from what's my task? I'm going to go off and do something by myself.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a challenge because it's a mindset. And I've also found even teams that were hardcore, this is how we've always done it. And they start to move over to this new paradigm. They're especially when you make all of the work items transparent, when you make them all visible, mm-hmm. And especially if they've been the ones that have really formulated the plan or the release or the backlog, there's automatic buy-in there because we've contributed in this, we've worked on it together. And being a little bit utopic here and going to rainbows and unicorns, if everybody has had a really successful process of generating story ideas and working through what I've just shared as a process, you've kind of baked in some of that camaraderie and some of that collaboration so that by the time they go to move on a story or work on something, they want to do it together because they've already talked it through to some degree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think without getting into the technical rabbit hole that constantly presents itself in front of me, there are some there are some practices to prevent that shadow IT that you're talking about, Paul. I mean, my mature teams are going to be working with pairing quite often, especially when you're talking about building something new.
Oh yeah, shout out to XP and all the folks that put that forth. Those practices still rock.
Yeah, but when you're looking at something that's novel, to use Mike's word, and one that I hear quite often from my British counterparts at work, if you're doing something new, the best way to approach a new problem or to develop a new solution is to put more than one brain against it. And the best way I know to do that today in the world of programming is either pairing or mobbing. And that's one way to make sure that you're not assigning tasks to people. And one other way is to kind of thwart the shadow IT is, just following, some good programming practices, linting your code, pull requests, constant check-ins, all of those things, because then you express a lot more of the work that's happening in a much more real-time fashion. So I think just any opportunity I get to ring that let's do things the right way bell, I'm going to try to ring it. So,
well, a better way, right? Yeah. A better way.
Yeah, a better way.
We're open to learning new things, but I'm totally with you. Yeah.
So I think, Mike, Paul, you kind of hit the nail on the head. We're closing in on some time here. Mike, I really love having you on, my friend. I think we're going to have to do this again. I feel like...
That'll be fun.
I think you brought a lot of fresh perspective, and obviously you have a depth of research in a lot of different areas. So, love having you on. If the listeners want to get a hold of you, if they want to ask you some questions about some of the concepts you push forward tonight, how can they track you down? And do you have any meetups or anything, any blogs or anything you want to promote or push out there?
Sure. You can find me on Twitter at Macker. And I did just put together a website. I spoke at Day of Agile in Cincinnati in July, and I went, shoot, I've got to get a consolidated place for all my thoughts so I can just put it one place, people can find it. So I did build a site called ack-labs.com, ack-labs, named after my father and my grandfather, who had an actual laboratory.
Cool.
And now it's a learning lab where wherever I am, I try to make it a learning lab.
Yeah, I'll make sure I get all those links in the show notes. Anything else that you wanna get out there?
You know, I did put down that I'd come to the next meetup, DevOps meetup, from where we met.
Oh, nice. The
and of course.
Yeah, so Mike is New York-ish local. So you're talking about the DevOps New York City meetup that is sponsored by my lovely company Contino. So yeah,
yes.
I'll make sure that gets in the show notes as well.
Cool.
Paul, yourself, I know you're an active social Twitter guy now, finally.
I'm an active social media guy. I've been LinkedIn for years, but I just started using Twitter. Like, I had an account, but I just started using it. So it's Paul _ V as in Victor _ Elia, E-L-I-A. LinkedIn, I'm... one word, Paul Elia, no space.
And Ryan Lockard, I'm on Twitter, AgilePHL. My events page it's actually got to get updated. I'll update it before we publish this. Have to change a couple things, which I'm sure is pissing some people off. I have to add a couple things, and I just got a bunch of new things scheduled, which changed up some existing things. But yep, I got a couple private corporate talks, a couple public talks. The public ones will be on my website. If you work for some.
And you're coming down Atlanta way this month or next?
Oh, dude, that's one of the ones I have to move.
Oh, man. All right, we'll see you soon.
Early 2018. It looks like early 2018, buddy. I'm sorry.
Oh, I know. Gee, okay. So,
how are we going to learn from that failure?
It's not a failure. Unfortunately, it's not a failure.
Yes, failure is the eye of the beholder.
It was so we can make sure we got it covered. We got a vibrant community in Atlanta. And
it's the one that has their logo looks like a bar of soap from Fight Club.
Oh, yes. Yeah, Scrum in the perimeter area. Got it.
Yep, cool. But completely not for the listeners. I'll be down in Atlanta, I think, in another couple weeks, so we'll catch up, buddy.
Cool.
Cool. Thank you, guys. We have the Agile Uprising podcast. If you've made it this far through the drivel, please consider giving us a follow at Agile Uprising. Give the podcast a subscribe either on iTunes or Stitcher. And please, we're begging for two things. We're begging for reviews, hopefully positive, of the podcast in your various podcast networks. And we're also begging for feedback.
Or negative.
Yeah. And we're begging.
Or negative, right? Prove or disprove.
Yeah. We're also begging for some feedback. Hit us up on Twitter. Yeah. If we said something that makes you go, oh, that's really cool. Or if we said something and you're like, these jackasses don't know what they're talking about. We want to hear from you. We want to invite you to the conversation. And if you got a strong point that you're passionate about, maybe invite you on the show. That's kind of how these other two guys got on, just through voicing their opinions.
That's exactly right.
So we invite that.
I didn't call you a jackass, though. I said I love you guys.
Yeah. What is it? Mike, remind me, what are we calling it? The healthy friction? What? How did you call it? The
creative abrasion.
Creative abrasion. We want your creative abrasion for feedback. So thank you guys both again. Mike, lovely to have you on for your first show. Paul, you're basically family now, so thanks for showing up.
Cool. Yep.
All right, guys. Talk to y'all later.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you very much.